From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Princes of Darkness by Frederick Cowles. In the spring of 1938, I was sent to Budapest on a rather delicate mission. For some years, diplomatic circles in at least 5 European countries had been somewhat puzzled about a certain Princess Bessenyi, who made sporadic appearances in the Hungarian capital and was vaguely suspected of being involved in international espionage. The lady first attracted notice early in 1925, when she suddenly appeared in Budapest and just as suddenly departed after dazzling her admirers for a little more than 2 months. Nearly a year passed before she was again seen in public, and thereafter, at varying intervals, she was back in the capital for periods of from 6 weeks to 3 months at a time. Lots of ugly rumors were whispered about the princess. It was said that her departures from the city always coincided with the mysterious death of men who were reputed to have been her lovers. There were those who even asserted that a woman, strangely like the princess, had been closely associated with Bela Kun, the notorious communist leader, and had inspired many of the bloody orgies perpetrated by his regime. This suggestion was treated as idle gossip, for who could credit a story which linked such a proud aristocrat with the lowest of the vile criminals who, for a brief time, held in their incompetent hands the reins of government in Hungary? No one could speak with any certainty of encountering the lady prior to 1925. The only facts one could accept with any degree of certainty were that the princess was a member of a very ancient Hungarian family, and that she appeared to have unlimited wealth at her disposal. Her claim to possess an estate on the borders of Transylvania was unquestioned, as a place called Bessenyi appeared on the map. The story that she was a spy was difficult to believe, as, so far as could be ascertained, Budapest was the only city she favored with her presence. Yet, the suggestion was taken seriously in certain quarters, and my journey to Hungary must have been backed by some definite information. My task was simply to become acquainted with the princess, and to discover, if possible, something of her background. Budapest, in the years between wars, was a favorite rendezvous for crooks of all types, as well as a very popular tourist resort. It was a lovable and romantic city, and I remember, with nostalgic pleasure, the twinkling lights along the Danube, the great floodlit statue of St. Gellert, and the eternal gypsy music throbbing through the night. István Zichy was one of our agents in those days, and we had become fairly close friends during my many visits to his country. He was an attractive young man, and being a count, moved in the best society. His greeting was very warm when we met at the Nugati Palvadar, and he chattered of trifling things as we drove to the Duna Palaura, where accommodations had been reserved for me. He became more serious in the privacy of my suite, and I was surprised to find that he regarded my mission with some uneasiness. "I don't like it, my friend," he said. "There is something uncanny about the woman. But it is all nonsense to suggest she's a spy. For myself, I'm of the opinion that she is thoroughly evil and a worshipper of the devil." He made a quick sign of the cross, and catching an involuntary smile on my face, continued, "Ah, you laugh at me and think that István grows superstitious. I am a Hungarian, and I know that in this country the old beliefs die hard. What do we know of this Princess Bessenyi? For a few months she stays with us in Budapest, and then back she goes to her castle near Arad, a castle which no one has ever visited, and which, to my certain knowledge, is little more than a ruin. She leaves the city, and immediately some young man who has enjoyed her favor dies in a strange fashion. Wait until you have seen the lady. I think you will find that cold shivers will go down your spine. But I protested. I have been led to believe that the princess is very beautiful. Certainly she is lovely, he replied. But I do not like her kind of beauty. A snake is a splendid thing, to those who like snakes. There is another queer point to which I must draw your attention. Why has this princess no relatives to show? Often she speaks of her father, but he never comes with her to Budapest, nor have I known of any person who has ever met him. Relations can be an awful nuisance at times, I laughed. Perhaps the lady prefers to keep hers in the background. Possibly she prefers to keep a lot of other things in the background, he replied. Well, my friend, I will help you all I can, but I do not envy you the job. Everything is arranged for you to meet the princess tomorrow night, and you can form your own conclusions. For myself, I think that if she is a spy, the government for which he works is ruled over by a gentleman with horns on his head. The following evening, at the Astoria, I was presented to the princess. István had carefully paved the way for the encounter, and I had been spoken of as a wealthy English nobleman visiting Hungary on my way to Constantinople. It is not easy to describe the princess, nor to set down my first impression of her. She was a slim woman of medium height, with auburn hair and piercing green eyes. She appeared to be about 30 years of age, and her face and hands were so pale that they seemed quite bloodless, although her lips were naturally red. I noticed that the hand she extended for me to kiss was intensely cold, and when she smiled, sharp, fang-like teeth were revealed. As the night advanced and I was able to examine the woman more closely, I became more and more uncertain about her. Although when animated her face was that of a young woman, in repose there was an indefinable air of age about it. Not a single wrinkle marred its loveliness, and yet, in those odd moments, it was old in the way that a flawless piece of ivory may have been carved centuries ago. Then, whilst her eyes were definitely green when the light reflected upon them, in the shadow they appeared almost black. For most of the time, she kept up a lively flow of conversation, discussing all manner of topics from the international situation to the play, then running to the Mazzetti Zindas. She ate nothing but a couple of peaches and drank only aerated water. This, I afterwards discovered, was her invariable practice, and no one had ever seen her eat a more substantial meal. The leader of the gypsy orchestra seemed to avoid her as much as possible, and his perambulations of the tables seldom paused by our party. When he did, he was careful to stand behind the princess. Once she snapped a remark at him, and I am sure I saw fear in the man's eyes. During the next few days, I encountered the princess on several occasions, and she always seemed pleased to see me. Within a week or so, we were on fairly intimate terms, and to tell the truth, I found her very fascinating, although, in some unaccountable way, I was afraid of her. One night we had been dancing at the Hungaria, and I was taking her back to the flat she rented in one of the old palaces in Buda. We had just crossed the Szeszeszi Lachin when the taxi lurched and threw her against me. I put out my arm to steady her, and she pressed herself against me, lifting her face with such obvious invitation in her eyes that I bent over and kissed her red lips. Her mouth opened, and I felt her sharp teeth pierce my lower lip. It all happened in a moment, and just as quickly she drew away from me with a long, satisfied sigh. Then she laughed softly. It was an unpleasant sound with no humor in it, and I felt that she was secretly gloating over gaining some purpose of her own. This impression was confirmed when we were parting, and she said very quietly, "Now you are mine forever. I think you will dream of me tonight." I did dream about her, and it was not a nice experience. As is my usual practice, I read for about half an hour and then switched off the light and settled down to sleep. I suppose I must have dozed off, for what followed could only have been a dream in spite of its seeming reality. I thought a ray of dull green light suddenly shone through the window, and upon it, floating into the room, came the Princess Bassenyi. She was dressed in a long white robe. Her teeth appeared abnormally long, and her eyes blazed like cold emeralds. I was powerless to stir or to utter one word, although I knew that those teeth would soon be fixed upon my throat. Closer she came, her mouth dripping with saliva in a most repulsive manner. She lifted the bedclothes, and then, like a snake darting upon its victim, she bent down to my neck. There was a sudden jar of metal upon bone, and I realized her teeth had struck the little silver crucifix which I always wear about my neck. With a bitter, frustrated cry, she stood erect, and I saw her pale face change in a most horrible manner. The cheeks sunk inward, the eyes became hollow sockets, the mouth a gaping hole. I was gazing upon the ghastly head of a corpse. From this nightmare I awakened in a cold perspiration to find the window wide open and the curtains billowing in the breeze. I did not get to sleep again that night. The following evening, István and I attended a gala performance at the opera. The princess was there with a party from the German embassy. During the interval, we went to the box to pay our respects, and the first thing I noticed was that her mouth was disfigured by a thin white scar, a mark which might have been made by a thin piece of hot metal. She observed my glance, and with a forced laugh, said something about being careless with a cigarette. Nearly a week passed before we met again, and then it was an accidental encounter in the Alakert, the Budapest Zoological Garden. The park was almost deserted, for it was a chilly day, and I came upon the princess by the house in which the Siberian wolves are kept. She had climbed inside the barrier and was stroking the animals through the bars of the cage. I was amazed to see the ferocious beast behaving like huge dogs, groveling at her touch and licking her hands. "Be careful," I exclaimed as I approached. "Surely it is hardly safe to tempt them with such dainty morsels." "They will not hurt me," she replied. "I am used to wolves, and know where they are dangerous." She swung herself through the rail and came to my side. For a few moments we stood looking at the animals, and then I invited her to take some refreshment with me in the restaurant. She excused herself, saying she never ate between meals, but suggested she should sit with me whilst I drank coffee. We went into the almost empty cafe, and sitting at a table against the wall, talked trivialities for a time. Suddenly she said, "Tell me, are you a Catholic?" I admitted the fact, and she went on, "Then perhaps you have such a thing as a small cross or holy medal you would give me for keepsake? Tomorrow I must go away, and we may never meet again." "I have a little crucifix which I always wear," I replied, "but it has a sentimental value, and I would not care to part with it. Let us go into the city, and I will buy you a small souvenir of our friendship." "No," she exclaimed rather pettishly, "I want something that has a real personal association, something you wear. You see, I have a fondness for you, and would wish to remember these happy days." I surprised a hard gleam in those green eyes, and knew that she was anxious to obtain possession of my cross, and that nothing else would satisfy her. I also realized that the crucifix was my shield against some unknown danger, and without it, I should be at the mercy of a power I did not understand. As casually as possible, I changed the subject, and we chatted amiably for another 10 or 15 minutes. Then I escorted her to the gates, where she called a taxi and held out her hand in farewell. As I kissed the cold fingers, she whispered, "You have refused my request, but the cross will not save you. You are mine forever, and I can afford to wait." The red lips parted in a mirthless smile as she gave a sharp instruction to the driver and was borne away. I was sufficiently disturbed by the events of the morning to seek out István and recount them to him. He listened without comment as I told of the princess's familiarity with the wolves and of her desire to possess my little crucifix. I also gave him a brief account of my unpleasant dream. "It all confirms my suspicions," he said when I had finished. "This apparently attractive woman is not what she seems. If I were to tell you exactly what I believe her to be, I am afraid it would tax your credulity. I am, however, convinced that, in your own interest, some immediate action must be taken to put a stop to something that is devilish. Will you do me the favor of telling your experience to my friend, Professor Otto Nemitz?" "Do you mean the famous psychic investigator and the author of so many learned books and monographs on occult subjects?" I inquired. "The very same. The professor is very interested in our friend the princess. I may feel disposed to give you some surprising information regarding the lady." "I shall be delighted to meet Nemitz," I replied. "I have read many of his works, and if the man is only half as interesting as his writings, he should be a remarkable individual." "I promise that you will not be disappointed," said Isvan. My friend took me along to Otto Nemitz's apartment, and having performed the necessary introductions, pleaded another engagement and left me alone with my host. The professor was utterly unlike what I had pictured him to be. Instead of the tall, scholarly man with a slightly sinister air which I had imagined, I found a small, rotund individual with merry, twinkling eyes. When Isvan had departed, Nemitz drew me over to the wide window and enthused about the wonderful vista of the Danube. It was certainly a marvelous scene from that fourth-floor balcony. The silver ribbon of the stream far below, the royal palace and the coronation church beyond, and to the north the blue heights of the encircling mountains. Suddenly the professor pulled me back into the room, closed the window, and said, "Now let us get down to business." He piloted me to a chair, taking a bunch of keys from his pocket, unlocked a drawer in his desk. Carefully withdrawing a parcel wrapped in green baize, he removed the covering and placed a small oil painting in my hands. It was a portrait of the Princess Bassigny, and the artist had caught, with uncanny skill, the wicked gleam of the green eyes and the bitter curl of the red lips. "It is a remarkable likeness," I exclaimed. "Who is the artist?"
"You mean, who was the artist?
It was painted by Nicholas Serdozzi, and he, it may surprise you to know, died in 1502. "But that is impossible," I protested somewhat feebly. "It is certainly a portrait of the Princess Bassigny, but according to your statement, it is over 400 years old."
"Exactly," replied the professor, drawing his chair closer to mine and speaking in a low tone. "That, in my opinion, is the age of the princess. I believe that this woman has troubled the world for over 400 years. Don't think me mad. Listen to what I have to say before you decide to dismiss my theories as fantastic dreams." He passed me the cigarettes and lit his own pipe before he continued. "In parts of Hungary, more especially in the Transylvanian district, a belief in vampires still exists. Throughout the centuries, it has been held that certain persons can, by evil arts, retain a semblance of life within the tomb. I need only refer you to Johann Christopher Hengenberg's book on vampirism as proof of the fact that this belief has been seriously studied by learned men. The unholy dead nourish their bodies upon the blood of living men and women, and when this sustenance is available, can walk the world and behave like normal people. Time and distance mean nothing to the vampire, and after a period of quiet rest in the grave, is capable of living like a human being for as long as 6 months at a time. And its lust for living blood, it is inspired by a passion which often resembles love, and its victims are frequently wooed by an artful courtship. Usually the vampire does not care to be away from its home for a long period, and in fact, it cannot manage this unless it obtains the nourishment it requires. Yet in the grave, it can retain the appearance of healthy life for hundreds of years, providing it rises from time to time to drink human blood. It is a recognized fact that certain families in this part of Europe were, in the Middle Ages, brought under the vampire curse through their own criminal activities. The Bassignys were one of these. In the 15th century, certain members of this family dabbled in the black arts, and the Prince Laurent was the worst of them all. He undoubtedly sold his soul to the evil one, and initiated his daughter, the Princess Gisela, in all the foul rites of Satanism. She became the terror of the countryside, an avowed murderess, who was eventually executed for misdeeds in 1506. Unfortunately, having regard for her rank, her body was interred in the chapel of Bassigny Castle. If it had been burned, much trouble would have been saved, for I am convinced that she and her father have been as active from the tomb as they were in life. At different times throughout the centuries, this woman has appeared in the world, and she is the person you know as the Princess Bassigny.
But surely, such a tale is ridiculous, I interrupted.
I am prepared to swear that the princess is a woman of flesh and blood, and I cannot believe that your theory will bear scientific investigation. After all, this is the 20th century.
She is certainly a creature of flesh and blood, replied Nemitz. But that flesh and blood is over 4 centuries old. I know it all sounds like a medieval fantasy, and yet I believe it to be true. I am so convinced that I am determined to prove my contention, and in doing so to rid the world of a devilish evil. Hungarians are naturally superstitious, and I should find it difficult to persuade any person in this country to give me the assistance I require. You are an Englishman and can help me if you will.
How is that possible? I asked in some trepidation, for remembering the strange incidents connected with my short acquaintance with the princess. I felt myself becoming convinced against my will.
Come with me to the castle of Bassigny, suggested the little professor. I can guarantee you protection against the undead, but I do not promise that the sights I may reveal will be pleasant. You are, I take it, a man with good nerves, and are not afraid of things which may live in your memory forever.
I am not afraid of anything I can understand, but this is quite beyond me, I replied. I have to find out all I can about the woman, and, for this reason, if for no other, I am prepared to help you, even to the extent of accompanying you to Bassigny.
Good, cried Nemitz. No time must be wasted, and we will start at 9 o'clock in the morning. Meanwhile, may it be as well for us to visit the Urzdagos Leveltar, the Department of State Archives, to see if we can obtain any information about the home of the Bassignys. He seized his hat and stick, and presently we were hurrying along the Horthy Miklos Ut. By the bridge, the professor signaled a taxi which carried us across the river to Buda, by the Coronation Church to the modern building and the Besh Kapu, there where all documents of the Hungarian state are housed. Soon we were closeted with a courteous official, who in the pleasant fashion of the country produced a bottle of wine before he dealt with our inquiry.
Yes, he said, I have heard of the castle, but so far as I can recollect, it is situated in disputed territory. I will, however, let you have all the information that is available. He rang a bell and instructed the subordinate, who answered the summons, to bring certain documents and maps. When these were before him, he gave us the startling intelligence that the Bassigny family, at least that branch of it which owned the castle, had become extinct in 1723.
But, I said, there is certainly a Princess Bassigny who is well known in Budapest society.
She probably comes from another branch of the family, he replied. Bassigny Castle, with its estates, seems to have become state property about the middle of the last century. The building can be little more than a picturesque ruin, and I see from our records that a caretaker was maintained there until the outbreak of the last war. Since the Treaty of Trianon, we have had no official connection with the estate, which appears to be in territory still the subject of litigation. If you wish to visit the place, you will encounter no difficulties, although I think it most unlikely that any custodian is on the premises. Certainly we have met no charges for maintenance during the past 20 or 30 years. Thanking him for his assistance, we parted with mutual expressions of goodwill, and Nemitz and I returned to Pest. Punctually at 9 o'clock the following day, the professor was at my hotel. He came up to my suite and, spreading a map on the table, pointed out the road we had to follow. The actual distance, he said, is little more than 100 English miles, but I am afraid the latter part of the journey will be by bad roads, and we cannot expect to arrive at our destination before late evening. It may be helpful if we can spend the night in the castle. Do you think you can face such an ordeal?
Having undertaken this adventure, I replied, I am in your hands. If you think we should spend the night in the building, I am quite agreeable.
Excellent. One more thing before we start. Are you wearing the crucifix about your neck?
I showed him the cross on its thin silver chain, and he gave a grunt of approval. He led me out to the waiting car, which he was driving himself. I noticed two traveling cases in the back seat, also a small crowbar. On the whole, it was a pleasant drive, with a brief stop at Kismet and Sisged. At the latter place we had a meal and inspected the splendid votive church. From Mako the roads were little more than dusty tracks through cornfields and vineyards. At last we came to a gloomy forest, and upon the edge of it was a gypsy encampment. Nemitz pulled up and called out to one of the men, asking if he could direct us to the castle. The fellow came over to the car and appeared to be afraid to answer the question. On the professor repeating his request, the gypsy burst into a torrent of words accompanied by urgent gestures. So far as I could make out, the castle was in the forest, but it was only a deserted ruin. It was an evil place, and we would be well advised to give it a wide berth. Nemitz laughed and said something about calling on the princess. This remark served to increase the man's agitation, and his incoherent warnings rang in our ears as we drove away.
"You see," said my companion, "even the gypsies are afraid of the castle, and know it to be the home of evil things."
It was so dark under the trees that we had to switch on the headlights to enable us to see the way. After about a couple of miles, there was a break in the trees and a pair of ruined columns, one still surmounted by a heraldic device, indicated the approach to a large house. In the distance we could see the outline of a tower. But the drive was overgrown and hardly distinguishable from the surrounding fields. Dusk was falling as we turned into the entrance, and suddenly there was a blood-curdling howl, and a gaunt gray wolf leapt from the shadows and bounded along at the side of the car. Nemitz applied the brakes, pulled out a revolver, and fired three rounds at the animal. At such short range, he could hardly have failed to hit it, but with a howl of rage, it reared up on its hind legs and then ran off among the trees. Then, from all over the forest, came the answering cries of a pack of wolves howling in anger. Beyond the shattered gates, the track led through a wilderness which must have originally been parkland. A few stunted trees hung above a reedy lake into which flowed the waters of a dark moat, which we crossed by a crumbling bridge. As we neared the castle, I could see that it was little more than a shell, with a round tower on the western side, and beyond it a detached building, which looked like a chapel. Drawing up before the main doorway, the professor handed me a powerful electric torch, and carrying a bag each, we climbed the broken steps.
"There is just a chance that there may be a caretaker in the place," said Nemitz, "although I think it most unlikely." He pulled a chain, which hung from a pillar, and far away inside the building a bell tolled with a hollow sound. As its echoes died, we heard the sound of shuffling footsteps, and the heavy door swung open. On the threshold stood a tall man, dressed in the dark costume of an old-fashioned retainer. He held a lighted candle in his hand, and the light fell upon a bearded face in which the eyes glowed with a curious red glow. I confess that I was afraid, and wished myself back in the pleasant comfort of the Duna Pelota, but the professor did not appear unduly alarmed.
"You are the custodian, I presume?" he asked.
The man gave a barely perceptible nod, and Nemitz went on.
"We are two travelers who desire shelter for the night. Can it be arranged?"
"The accommodation is poor," was a reply in a thin, fluting voice. "But you are welcome to such as it is. Enter, gentlemen. Enter of your own free will and become the guest of Castle Bassenier."
He stood aside, holding the candle high, and we entered the building. The hall, which appeared to be in a tolerable state of repair, stank of damp and decay. A ragged tapestry fluttered on one wall, but the others were green with mildew. Our guide gave us a little chance to examine our surroundings, for after slamming the door he led the way up a wide staircase, along a narrow corridor on the first floor, and ushered us into a room at the end of it. It was apparently a large apartment, and the feeble light of the candle revealed a bare floor, a heavy table, two chairs,
and an oak settle. "This is the best we can offer," said the strange custodian. "I trust you have food with you, for there is none in the castle. You will, I hope, find this better than a night spent in the forest." With a soft chuckle, he added, "It is many years since we entertained guests in Castle Bassenier." "Can you light a fire?" demanded the professor. "The room is as cold as a tomb." "I regret there is no fuel in the castle," was the reply. "This is all we can provide. A roof over your heads and chairs in which you can wait the dawn. Even a tomb is not so cold as the living believe." As he spoke, the howl of a wolf sounded from under the windows. With a muttered word of apology, he grabbed the candle and hurried from the room, leaving us in the semi-darkness. The door had hardly closed when Nemitz quietly opened it again and, beckoning me to follow, led the way along the passage to the head of the stairs. The old man was descending, and his candle cast queer shadows on the damp walls. Moving with a strange gliding motion, he hurried over to the heavy door and flung it open. At once a long gray shape bounded over the threshold, and I started back in fear. But immediately before our eyes, the wolf changed into a woman. It was the Princess Bassenier. We heard the muttering of low conversation, and then the woman raised her eyes and looked to where we were standing. The professor pulled me back into the deeper shadow, and we watched as the two figures below moved towards a door near the foot of the stairs and vanished through it. We waited a few moments and then silently crept back to our room. "Now we know exactly where we stand," said the professor, driving home the rusty bolt on the door. "The princess is here, and it is obvious that the custodian is not what he pretends to be. We must prepare ourselves for the night." From the case, he unpacked the portable electric lamp, which was powerful enough to illuminate the somber chamber. We saw that the dust of years covered the floor and the barred windows were festooned with cobwebs. A coat of arms was carved above the wide stone fireplace, and this was repeated over each of the two windows. Nemitz then produced handfuls of garlic and spread the herb on the threshold of the rooms and on the window sills. On the table he placed a pair of brass candlesticks containing long yellow tapers, which he lighted. "We are now safe from direct attack," he explained. "For some reason the undead loathe the smell of garlic, and it has always been considered a sure protection against their spells. The candles were blessed by the Archbishop last Candlemas day, and to make things doubly sure, I shall now sprinkle a room with holy water." He took a flask from his pocket and, reciting the prayer of the Asperges, spray drops of the blessed water into every corner of the apartment. He then drew the chairs up to the table and ate a light meal of sandwiches, washed down with a bottle of seltzer water. "It will be safe enough to sleep," said the little man, when we had finished our repast. "But on no account must you attempt to leave the room or to open the door or windows." For a while we chatted of ordinary things, which seemed ridiculously unreal in those sinister surroundings, but I was very tired and could feel my lids growing heavier. After a time I saw that my companion was finding it difficult to remain awake. Suddenly he slumped over the table and settled his head on his arm. I also must have fallen asleep, and yet it seemed that I never closed my eyes. I became aware of a reddish glow, which appeared to come from the fireplace and eventually resolved itself into minute particles of gleaming dust, which danced in the light of the electric lamp. Gradually they took shape, misty at first and then more clearly defined, until the Princess Bassenier stood before me. Her green eyes were tender and inviting, as she beckoned me to follow her. I knew that I must remove the crucifix from my neck before I could rise from the chair, but I found it impossible to lift my hands. I was chained to the spot and could not move. The woman's face changed as she watched my fruitless efforts to obey her unspoken command. Angry frustration blazed from her eyes, her mouth twisted into a horrible dribbling leer, and she bared the white fangs of her teeth. Then the figure became blurred, and a cloud of red dust hung in the light of the lamp before it faded away. The hungry cry of a wolf echoing through the ruined castle awakened me. Nemitz was already on his feet, and he put his finger to his lips to enjoin silence. From beyond the door came the sibilant whisper of voices, and then the wolf's howl rang out again. "There is nothing to fear," the professor assured me. He went on to explain that the vampire frequently assumes the shape of a wolf, and in this guise is able to satisfy its lust for blood. I suppose the even murmur of his voice must have lulled me off to sleep again. When I awakened next time, it was morning, and the sun blazed through the dirty window. The little man was bending over a Primus stove, and the warm, friendly aroma of coffee pervaded the apartment. We made a good breakfast, for Nemitz had brought a liberal supply of food. I noticed, however, that no meat was provided, and this was explained when the professor remarked that in dealing with the occult, it was best to avoid flesh meat. After the meal, we packed everything back into the cases in readiness to carry them out to the car. "The real business of our visit remains to be performed," said my companion. "The task we have set ourselves is to rid the world of this evil creature, and we shall require all our courage if we are to succeed. God grant we do not fail." He opened the door, and we were carrying our things into the passage when I stopped with a sudden exclamation. Just over the threshold, written in the dust on the floor, were the words, "You are mine forever." Nothing I had experienced during my association with the princess had affected me as did that strange message. I literally trembled with fear, and it took all Nemitz's assurances to restore some of my self-control. Even then, I would have backed out of the business if I could have done so honorably. There was no sign of the old man we had seen on the previous evening, and in the cold light of the day, the castle looked an utterly abandoned ruin. We peeped into some of the rooms on the ground floor. Apart from a few broken articles of antique furniture, they were quite empty. In what had evidently been the dining hall, some of the carved paneling had been roughly ripped from the walls, and birds were nesting in the crevices. Before we packed the bags into the car, Nemitz removed certain articles and placed them in his capacious pocket. These included a wooden crucifix, a wooden-looking dagger, a handful of garlic, and the bottle of holy water. Taking the crowbar in his hand, he led the way toward the chapel. The little building probably dated from the early 14th century and was graceful in design. The door opened to our touch, and a wave of cold, dank air greeted us. The interior was filthy and littered with fallen masonry. A few fragments of colored glass remained in the windows, and there was a stone altar at the east end. The professor mounted the steps and examined the slab. It was covered with the droppings of birds and scrapings. Some of the dirt away, he pointed to dark brown patches, which stained the center of the table. He also showed me that the 5 consecration crosses had been roughly obliterated, and the receptacle for relics was empty. "Here are the marks of unholy sacrifices," he said, "and proofs that this altar has been used for the wicked blasphemy of the Black Mass." At the back of the altar, we found a flight of narrow steps leading down into the depths of the earth. At the bottom was a small door, marked with the same coat of arms we had seen in the castle. "Now comes the real test," said Nemitz. "This is the burial vault of the Bassegni family, and here we shall find the evidence we seek. Let us pray for strength to enable us to finish this awful business." Beside the desecrated altar, we knelt and asked heaven to bless our efforts and to shield us from evil. Then the professor led the way down the steps and tried the door of the vault. It was apparently secured, but the rusty lock soon gave way before the crowbar and the door swung inward. With a wild shriek, which froze the blood in our veins, something flapped out of the darkness and soared toward the roof of the chapel. It was only a great white owl, but our nerves, keyed almost to breaking point, were badly shaken. Speaking for myself, I would, at that moment, gladly have abandoned the task we had set ourselves. But the professor soon recovered himself and, with a self-conscious laugh, directed the beam of his torch into the vault. A ghastly sight met our eyes. Coffins of all shapes and sizes were ranged in niches around the walls, and most of them had been broken open. Here and there bones protruded, and the floor was covered with fragments of human bodies, some of them with dried scraps of flesh still adhering. In the center of the place, two great leaden coffins stood side by side.
"These are the ones we want," said the professor, advancing into the vault. "The others are of no importance, for we can see that their inmates have suffered the normal course of corruption." He placed the torch in my hands and motioned me to hold it, so that the light fell upon the first of the two coffins. Then, with a crowbar, he prized the lid and found that it was not sealed in any way. He moved it a little, so that he could get a grip on the edges. Evidently it was not so weighty as he had anticipated, for he lifted it off with comparative ease. There, before us in the leaden casket, was the body of a man we had taken to be the caretaker of the castle. He appeared to be sleeping, and, in repose, the cruel lines of his mouth were set in an evil grin.
"Just as I suspected," muttered Nemitz. "This is Prince Laurent, who is supposed to have died in the 15th century. You see for yourself how he lives in the grave and can arise when occasion demands. Now let us look at the other." We turned to the second coffin, and without any difficulty, the two of us lifted the lid and placed it on the floor. I was more or less prepared for the sight that met our eyes, but even so, it gave me a nasty shock. The light of the torch showed us the Princess Bassanier, to all intents and purposes, resting quietly in the tomb. She could hardly be described as sleeping, for her wicked eyes were wide open and gleamed with mocking scorn. Looking upon that beautiful face, it was hard to believe that this woman had roamed the earth for over 4 centuries, and that the source of her immunity from death was the blood of the innocent people who became her victims. Yet I was convinced at last. We turned back to the first coffin, and the professor drew his dagger. Whispering to me to hold the torch steady, he raised his arm and plunged the weapon deep into the heart of the thing in the casket. An unearthly scream of agony came from the twisted lips. The body writhed in grotesque fashion for a few moments, and then, before our eyes, it turned to dust. Nemitz, who seemed quite unmoved, put a few bulbs of garlic into the coffin and sprinkled it with holy water. We were bending to lift the lid when I dropped the torch and plunged the vault into darkness. Before I could retrieve it, a burst of harsh laughter rang out. We both sprang, round and there, framed in the narrow doorway and wrapped in a pale phosphorescent glow. Was the princess, with her green eyes, blazing with hellish anger. In a second, the professor had drawn his revolver and emptied it into the figure. He might have spared himself the trouble, for the shots had no effect at all. Lifting her hand in a commanding gesture which seemed to paralyze us into immobility, the princess addressed us. "You, Professor Nemitz," she said, "have taken my father from me, and for this you will pay the penalty. You have failed to destroy me, and nothing can save you from my vengeance when the hour comes, for the undead do not forget." Then turning to me, she smiled a slow, mysterious smile. "There is no need for me to tell you again that you will be mine in the end. Your lips have touched mine, and although years may pass and seas may divide us, I shall come for you in my own good time." With these words, she vanished from our sight. Power was suddenly restored to our limbs, and we rushed up the steps into the chapel. There was no sign of the princess, but with a hoot of derision and a flapping of wings, the great white owl swooped down and flew back into the vault. The professor seemed very badly shaken. "Too late," he groaned. "Too late. I should have realized that she is too skilled in her evil arts to allow herself to be destroyed by the usual methods." We made our way back to the car and were soon driving through the forest. Nemitz hardly spoke a word. He drove as if trying desperately to escape from a pursuing terror, and we were back in Budapest by the late afternoon. I gave him a stiff brandy in my room, but all life seemed to have gone out of him. "I must again seriously warn you of the danger in which you stand," he said before we parted. "This creature has a passion for you, which resembles to some degree the passion of violent love. It will never be content until you have become its victim, even if it has to wait many years. I can only urge you to protect yourself by every means in your power. I fear for you, and I also fear for myself. The princess has promised to have her revenge, and I am convinced it will not be long before the attack comes. God be with you, my friend. If all is well, I will call upon you in the morning." I never saw Professor Nemitz alive again. That same night he was killed in most brutal fashion. The authorities decided that some wild animal had gained access to the poor man's apartment, though how it was impossible to determine, for he was literally savaged to death. But I know how and why he died. I saw the glazed terror in his dead eyes and remembered the gaunt gray wolf of Bessigny. My turn will come. I feel safe with a little cross around my neck, but she will find some way of overcoming its power. I write down the story so that the truth may be known, and perhaps in God's good time, someone will be brave enough to again attempt the destruction of the undead. I leave the city with fear in my heart, for I know she will follow me to the ends of the earth. Postscript by Dr. Reginald Staines, Medical Officer in Charge of East Down Mental Home, Devon. The foregoing manuscript was written by Harvey Gorton, a former member of the Diplomatic Service, who was admitted to this institution on 10th November 1939. His was a case of psychosis, the chief feature of which was a fixed delusion that he was being hunted by the woman he called the Princess Bessigny. Apart from this, he was apparently normal and never caused any trouble. I found him a most cultured man, and we often chatted together about the international situation. He was very perturbed about the war and seemed particularly anxious that Hungary, for which country he had a great affection, should not be drawn into the conflict. In the ordinary course of events, I think we should have effected a complete cure within a few months. On 2nd December, after a light fall of snow, he was walking in the grounds when he stumbled over the root of a tree and fell some 5 or 6 feet down an embankment, injuring his left shoulder. He was evidently in great pain, and an x-ray revealed a fracture in a bad position at the upper end of the humerus. It was decided to give an anesthetic for reduction. Gorton always wore a little crucifix at his neck, and I noticed that when the surgeon lifted it aside to enable him to examine the shoulder more carefully, the man became unduly agitated and protested that the cross must on no account be removed. We injected pentothal into a vein in the arm, and as Gorton was becoming unconscious, the nurse, by some clumsy movement, broke the chain on which the cross was suspended, and it fell to the floor. The patient was only out for about 40 seconds, and when he was taken back to his room, the crucifix was apparently forgotten. Later, he became very anxious about the loss and worked himself up into such a state that I gave instructions for it to be restored to him. Unfortunately, the operating theater had been swept, and although the cross had been found, it had been locked up in the desk of the matron. She had gone off duty, and it was impossible for us to secure the thing until she returned. I tried to soothe Gorton, but he made a terrible fuss about the business and demanded that the desk should be broken open. As he seemed likely to become violent, I gave him a strong sleeping draught as the best way out of the difficulty. Later in the evening, having ascertained that the patient was sleeping soundly, I went over to the vicarage for an hour to discuss with the vicar's wife the formation of some first aid classes. I had hardly settled down when the telephone rang and I was recalled to the home. The whole place was in confusion. My deputy, Dr. Snell, reported that about 5 minutes after I had left, the woman, speaking with a foreign accent, had called at the home and asked to see Gorton. She was shown into a waiting room whilst the nurse went to inform Snell of the request. He naturally said it was quite impossible for Gorton to be seen, and the nurse, returning to inform the visitor, found the waiting room empty. At that moment, she heard a terrified scream, and members of the staff, rushing upstairs, discovered the door of Gorton's room wide open. The poor wretch was lying half in and half out of bed, and was already dead. When I came to examine the corpse, I found that it was almost entirely drained of blood, a most difficult condition to describe or explain. The only wound on the body was a tiny double puncture in the throat.